When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we're way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Welcome to another edition of On the Continent, your one-stop shop for everything to do with European football. I'm Dotun Adebayo.
I'm Andy Russell.
And I'm Nikki Bandini.
On this Who Will Be the Champions of Europe edition of the pod, after their epic semi-final battles, who's got what it takes to win the Champions League, Liverpool or Madrid? Also, with three games to go, will Serie A be black and red, or will Milan be wondering, what did they do to be so black and blue? And as the Conference League reaches the end of its inaugural season, was it worth it? Got two epic battles in the semi-finals of the Champions League. I don't know where we should go with this. Let's take both of them into the context, because were they the results you expected at the end of the day, either of you?
I wouldn't say they were results that are completely unexpected. The way we got there in both semi-finals was not what I expected, is fair to say. The second leg of the game between Manchester City and Real Madrid was more what I was expecting for the entire tie. I always kind of felt that the first leg was a little bit of a red herring, that the way City started that just so tempestuously conditioned the rest of it. Real Madrid would have loved to. The idea that some people were floating afterwards is that Real Madrid love to attack. They really don't. You know, they're a team that would prefer, especially in the European context, to sit deep, defend, and hit on the counter. But because Manchester City absolutely blew them away in the opening part of that, and, you know, when Manchester City have their regrets, of course, they'll look back at the end of the second leg at the Bernabeu. But really, that they had their chance in the first half of the first leg. And if it's 3-4 nil, then you know the whole rest of it is completely different. But I think that second leg at the Bernabeu, I don't know about you, Nicky, but I thought, you know, sometimes we can let how a match ends, not just the result, but how a match ends, condition how we thought the entire match was. And I did think that until Riyad Mahrez scored, they were being put through the ringer a bit.
Yeah, Madrid created chances.
Yeah.
Madrid did not. I think there was definitely sort of a version of that story being told that City had sort of cruised on through and look, sure, that they were 1-0 up and you know, when Jack Grealish comes on and could score and it could have been done. But Madrid had chances. I think that was probably the reason people felt like that is because none of those chances felt like the chance. If you know what I mean, like
because they managed to miss them by quite a long way. I mean, there are a couple, especially in the first half, where Benzema, being current Benzema, is normally gobbling those up.
Yeah,
which I think was the surprising thing.
Mm.
I think even more surprising than, you know, for people who are expecting.
Header.
Yeah, especially that where he just like walks into the ground between Diaz and Laporte, and they end up. Well, they end up discussing it for the next 25 minutes, don't they? It's like Diaz is going, no, you're meant to come to the ball. And Laporte's going to him, where were you? Where were you? And it's extraordinary to see, like, you know, two of the premier central defenders in Europe sort of discussing that. But
I'll tell you what, for Benzema, arguably he's got a good shout for the best assist or the most important assist of the season.
For the opener by Rodrigo,
that was amazing.
It was.
But is it? Should we be talking about the coaches here? Because
I think so.
Yeah, because we're talking about certainly three of the acknowledged greatest coaches in Europe at the moment, if not in the world, in these semi-finals. And I think we should give a shout out to Unai Emery as well. We'll come on to Unai Emery as we've started with Man City. Versus Real Madrid, or the other way around if you prefer, Ancelotti versus Pep Guardiola. Ancelotti, we talk about him regularly. Do we give him the respect, Nicky?
I think we absolutely don't, but I've thought this for a while. This isn't a new opinion for me. I actually remember doing a live show a little while ago where that came up, where someone was asking, a panel of us on stage asking, is Jurgen Klopp the greatest manager in the world? And I was saying, well, you can make a case for Jurgen Klopp, but I mean, I can also make a case for Carlo Ancelotti, because Carlo Ancelotti at that point has already won the league in Germany, in Italy, in England. Now he's also won the league in Spain. He's won 3 Champions Leagues already, which no one has done before. I feel like when you look at his achievements in football, the idea that he shouldn't be considered in the very top echelon is, the idea that anyone wouldn't consider him there, I find absurd, actually. And I think he hasn't, by a lot of people, being considered in that echelon. I think there's this sort of tendency to view him, perhaps in part because his domestic trophy haul, despite winning in different countries, hasn't been as big as it could have been, right? Like, because he could have won more at Milan, because he could have won more at Madrid, because he could have won a second Bundesliga trophy. There's been this sort of tendency to view him as this sort of avuncular, almost sort of unlikely figure who just comes along and wins the Champions League, which, you know, first of all, stop and consider that for a minute, because there's a lot of managers who don't do that, by the way. But second of all, I think it's just sort of, you know, odd to me, like, how dismissive people have been for a long time about his sort of tactical chops, just because he has this laid back demeanor. And this is not actually, shouldn't be new information to anyone. You know, he comes up with the Christmas tree formation at Milan that propels them to the Champions League, to a Champions League trophy, that was then a model that was broadly copied all over Europe a lot. And sure, it's been twisted and turned and become different things since, because that's what happens in football. People are always innovating. But so it's not like he's never done anything tactically innovative. And I also think this sort of easy to dismiss way, that because he's a bit more laid back, especially when you contrast it, and it was such a perfect contrast in this semi-final with Pep Guardiola, who's obsessive, who wants to be on top of every detail, who can't contain himself in the dugout, while Carlo stands there with one eyebrow raised, one goal down, and 60 yes. seconds left, going, you know, it's such a visual contrast. But I think people miss that that's part of it. That is part of it.
It is. The projection's huge, isn't it? I mean, we've got a question here from Whiskey Football Club on Instagram. It says, just how underrated is Carlo Ancelotti? It's ludicrous that he should be overrated. Mm. Underrated, sorry, when you look at that list of honours. But I do feel with head coaches, because we've got this sort of cult of the coach, it's like we need them to underline their philosophy to us.
Yeah.
And he, like in a very different way, a previous Real Madrid coach, Zinedine Zidane, never wanted to discuss tactics. So it led to, he hasn't got any tactics. He just like whispers to the players. Mm-hmm. But what you were saying about the Christmas tree, the thing he did at PSG actually, where he reconvened that 4-4-2 and he got the best out of Pastore by using him rather than behind the front two as a kind of left winger who came inside. All of that sort of good stuff. He's got so many ideas. And every time he goes to a club, like when he got to Napoli, we've talked about this on here before. When he went to Napoli, he's like, right, what did I do wrong at Bayern Munich? And how could I change that? Big coaches don't look at football like that. They go, how can I, like, if it's not going right, I need to go back to what worked for me before. Not how can I change? Mm-hmm. How has football changed? They don't look at football like that. I think the interesting thing...
Napoli's a great example, by the way, because I think Napoli, he didn't do that well in the league and that was a bit of a disappointment in the end. But
he got them to the next level in the Champions League.
Right, the two games against Liverpool in the Champions League that they played, he outmaneuvered Klopp in both those games, as I recall it. Mm. That's definitely the impression I came away with. Worse players. He had a worse squad than Liverpool had. And yet Napoli played better football in those games.
But you know, when we talk about mentality, and I think particularly in reference to this and the way this ended between Real Madrid and Manchester City, it is quite interesting, isn't it, with Guardiola, who's gone a long time now without winning the Champions League, as we've underlined, he looks really antsy on the touchline.
This is really important what you said, because Nicky said a moment ago about Ancelotti's raised eyebrow. It's inscrutable. Mm. I don't know what that raised eyebrow actually means. However, with Pep Guardiola, you know when things aren't going right because he's jumping up and down and everything.
Rubbing his head really hard.
I wonder whether that is part of why people don't rate Ancelotti on the same level as the greatest
And I actually think that's one of his strengths, because he said this before, you know, Madrid, while he's been there, it's not just even in the Champions League, but there's been a few in the league of really late comebacks this season. Mm. And he said before this thing about 60 seconds is a long time in football. And I think that projection of outward sort of, I don't even know if calm is the right word, just consistency of just, you know, I always come back to this because it sort of fascinated me at the time when I was told it. Probably this information isn't even in date anymore and I should go and speak to someone who knows about it to get more detail. But I had a friend who's very interested in baseball who talked to me about when they sort of went into the statistics to try and find out if there's such a thing as a clutch player. Mm. They found that actually you didn't see, even amongst sort of players who've won all these things, you didn't see evidence of much, if any, players raising their game in big key moments. But you saw some players who dropped off. So really the idea of clutch, of being someone who can handle the big situations, came down to just being consistent.
Mm. It's just maintaining your level when you're under pressure.
And I think Ancelotti projects that. Ancelotti projects whatever's happening, I'm here and I'm doing what I do. And I think that to high-level sort of footballers who are all capable of extraordinary things, which Madrid is jam-packed with, that calm projection is what you need sometimes. And I wonder, for all Pep's undoubted brilliance, which he is brilliant, and I would never diminish what Pep Guardiola is as a coach, but I wonder if sometimes his players could do with a bit of that as well.
Yeah, I sometimes think it is about the baggage you take with you, and that's certainly what it is in the big occasion. It does feel like all this talk about, clearly in his own passive-aggressive way, Guardiola has been very annoyed by the implication that he does tactically crazy stuff in the big moment, you know. And I think it's right that journalists ask him about it. I think it's right that he has to address it. But by trying to make a joke of it, it wasn't a joke at all. Whereas I think it's Ancelotti's demeanour. When he was asked several weeks ago, when Real Madrid are miles away at the top of the league before they've actually clinched the league title, as they did last weekend by beating Espanyol, as they did between the two legs, is one of the journalists on the normal Madrid beat said, well, you know, you can't lose the league from here, can you? And he said, well, you can't lose a Champions League by when you're 3-0 up at half time, can you? And I think the fact that he brought that up mm-hmm. and felt relaxed about it, like the past is the past. You know, you can't change what's gone, but you can change the future. Mm-hmm. And to have that, that's genuine cool, isn't it? That's genuine clarity.
Mm-hmm.
Look, we won't anticipate what's going to happen in the final. Let's leave that to a subsequent OTC.
Yeah.
But we should talk about Unai Emery now. He faced Jurgen Klopp. And talk about underrated coaches. He manages to get Villarreal, this tiny little place in the eastern part of Spain, to the Champions League semi-final for the second time ever. And talk about underrated coaches. If there's anybody who's underrated in Europe, it's got to be him, hasn't it?
And he's good at leaving the past in the past as well. Just like Ancelotti. You know, they're not comparable in a lot of ways. I mean, Emery's more in the Guardiola mould, isn't he? Not in the playing the same sort of football, but he's a very details-orientated coach. I mean, something that you said to me, Nicky, about Carlo Ancelotti that really stuck with me, he's one of these rare coaches that treats the players like adults. You know, he's not that prescriptive. Emery's the opposite of that, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny because, of course, as an Arsenal fan, I sort of have this sort of conflicted personal feeling about Emery because, of course, there was a lot of seeing him in a Champions League final, oh, he didn't get given a fair rub at Arsenal. I think you can say that things weren't really heading in the right direction for him at Arsenal, but that doesn't take away from him as a coach because Ancelotti, we've just talked about, has had some jobs where it didn't really work out for him as well. You can be a great coach and have different settings.
But that's a very Italian view, if you don't mind me saying so, of things,
maybe,
isn't it?
Yeah.
That like getting sacked is part of being a coach.
Yeah.
Whereas still in England, being sacked is kind of like, it's like a red cross against you, isn't it?
It's just like a personal failing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Rather than something that's part of a coach's natural life cycle.
Exactly. And I think that's really important. I think it's important to say about Ancelotti. Like, and I think that different settings suit different coaches better or worse. And I think, with Ancelotti, I think in the end, maybe he isn't built for a relegation dogfight. Maybe he's never going to be the coach you should be bringing in to do that. But he knows how to handle these grand settings with calm and sort of confidence that few could do. I think Emery has got a different persona to him. I think he almost sort of fits better in that slightly underdog role of sort of understanding the limitations and possibilities of his squad. And I think over two legs, he nearly got it right against Liverpool. He did, you know, he got so much criticism in that first leg for coming and not playing with any ambition. But then for 45 minutes in that second leg, he got Villarreal. You know, stop and look at the players who are in that team. Francois Coquelin and these are not guys who would get anywhere close to Liverpool starting 11. They're not close to it. And yet they really rocked Liverpool. And if it wasn't for, and I don't want to throw him under the bus either, but Rudy, because he has had a good tournament, but Rudy's chaotic second half, who knows what happens in that second half if it isn't for a goalkeeper having one of the sort of, I think, one of the worst European performances since Loris Karius at Liverpool.
It's funny. I think Rudy has kind of drawn fire, actually, from Emery. Because I think you're right. First half, he gets it completely right. In the away leg, it's mostly right. It's just they're Liverpool. So they beat you 2-0 instead of
1-0. If they got through that leg at 1-0, it would have been a completely different story, I think.
Exactly. And they played the first half they needed to against Liverpool because, I mean, I've mentioned this on the ramble. I said beforehand, they've got to play the same first half that they did in the first leg against Bayern. Not for a minute did I think they'd be capable of doing it.
Mm.
And they did do it. But their luck ran out because it was clear from about the 30th, 35th minute that Gerard Moreno could not go on anymore. They'd got a really good half out of him. They should have called it quits there because they weren't good enough without the ball in the second half. They didn't have that out ball because he couldn't move, really. And he's the one who not only holds it up, he plays in people around him. That's why you get like Francis Coquelin coming into the box, for example, or Etienne Capoue. They needed to change it about then. And I think Rui is a convenient fall guy. I think it's obvious that they ran out of gas. Like, they didn't keep up the pace in the second half against Bayern, just like they didn't against Liverpool. But they found a way to sit and soak better, and they found a way to counter-attack better. And that's what they couldn't find about Liverpool. Of course, part of that is Liverpool's great quality as well. But
of course, if it had been a different story altogether, I wouldn't have been able to end this segment by saying it feels like 2018 all over again.
Rodrigo la bajaba Militao, se viene contra Grealish, ahí está Carvajal, Real Madrid, finale del partido, el centro vino. ¡Gol, gol, 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 gol! ¡Gol! ¡Gol! ¡Rodrigo! ¡Gol!
So, at the top of Serie A, a battle between the two Milan clubs. Milan are trying to win their first Serie A since, unbelievably, 2010 to 2011. But they've been off at the pace for a few years now. So that won't come as a surprise to you. Given that, though, can they hold off the rearguard action from Inter?
It's very hard to feel confident of anything in this Serie A title race. Everyone has taken turns to blow their chance, sort of one at a time. I think the last round of games last weekend was the first time since early January that all three of the top three teams have won on the same weekend. So
Wow. That
gives you some indication of how things have been going. And of course, it's only a minute ago that Inter were in the driving seat. They had that game in hand against Bologna that they've been holding on to for a very long time. Holding on to, it wasn't their choice to hold on to it, but there was a game that they had in hand for a long time. And everyone expected them to win that. And then you get, Ionut Radu, the backup goalkeeper, comes off the bench, starts a game to give Handanovic a rest. He's having some back problems, has a swing and a miss at a ball in the area, and suddenly Inter lose to Bologna and the whole story's been turned on its head. Milan are in first place, and I think it's just impossible not to look at this weekend. So, I mean, bears saying that all of their games remaining are harder than Inter's on paper. They've got three top half teams, Inter have got three bottom half teams. But this weekend in particular, they play Hellas Verona. Now, Hellas Verona have this history with Milan going back decades and decades, because in 1973, I think it was, and again in 1990, they were the team that effectively denied Milan the league title. So in the first instance, it's literally the last day of the season. Milan go into the last game against Verona, top of the table, with Lazio and Juventus both a point behind them. And completely blow it against Verona. They were 3-0 down, I think, by half time, ended up losing 5-3. Lazio also didn't win. In fact, there was a certain point where it looked like you're going to have Lazio and Juventus both drawing, and it was going to be a three-way tie, which would have at that time required a big playoff to unpick it.
Amazing.
Which would have
Amazing.
Been incredible. But instead, Juventus ended up winning against Roma. And then in 1990, it was the penultimate round of games. And we're talking about an Inigo Sacchi side that's just come off a winning the semi-final of the European Cup, is about to go and win the European Cup, but blows its lines against Verona again. So there's this headline, Fatal Verona, that gets brought up again and again and again. Verona is fatal to Milan. And it's almost, funnily enough as well, I think it's almost sort of perfect, or would be perfect in that narrative, that you've gone, first time it was the last day of the season, second time it was the penultimate day of the season, now they're facing them three games from the end of the season. So is it going to repeat itself? Is certainly this sort of fascinating narrative.
That two households, both alike in dignity, you know that, in fear of Roma, where we lay our seat. I couldn't resist that one.
I imagine.
But Inter are going for back-to-back titles. Mm. Their 20th, it will be, in Serie A, incredibly. But Milan seem to have the harder run into the end of the season with their last three games. They're playing teams who were mid-table, let's say, pretty much, but Inter are playing teams that are even lower than that in the league. Does that make sense, though? Does it make sense that Inter have got the advantage in that respect?
The problem is you just don't know with teams, do you? Because being where you are in top half or bottom half doesn't necessarily mean a lot in and of itself, because teams sometimes have more to play for. And some teams are just sort of indifferent mindsets, even if they don't have things to play for. Verona.
Is it Cagliari the case in point for Inter, aren't they?
Yeah.
They've got to go there.
Well, Cagliari are very much...
And they'll need to win, won't they?
In the relegation fight.
Yeah.
And for instance, last week, Milan played Fiorentina, and Fiorentina are a top-half team who, you know, as I was saying, maybe not quite on the beach yet, but perhaps they've sort of started packing their bag to go. You know, they weren't really there, and
as
it was a goalkeeping error that gifted Milan that win again, and it was definitely not the Fiorentina they would have played a month ago, I think. Whereas Verona under Igor Tudor have been very, very difficult for people to beat and on a pretty good run of results, even though they're currently ninth. So they're not really going anywhere. But indications are they're still playing out this end of the season. They're still, again, winning games. So you just don't know really, I think, with any of these matches until you get to the the game itself. And again, Bologna is a great case in point, because actually Bologna have taken points off both Milan and Inter in the last few weeks. And Bologna perhaps wouldn't be fighting this hard, but Sinisa Mihailovic is back in hospital fighting leukemia again, which he said this sort of ongoing fight with. And you can just see in that team that the whole team who went to celebrate the win over Inter underneath his hospital window is just doing everything they can to play for him. And so I think when it comes to the end of the season, every game is a potential banana skin. And especially because in the end, I've loved this title race. I think it's been the most enjoyable title race in Italy for a long time. But I think that part of the reason it's so enjoyable is all of these teams are quite flawed.
Not least because I suppose you expect more from a manager with the name Inzaghi at the back of it. You know, he arguably is struggling this season. And if they don't win the title, will he still be there?
Well, I think it's quite a difficult question, really, isn't it? Because I think globally, you look at the season and you think he's put out a lot of fires. It's not the job that he signed up for. Of course, he was already succeeding Antonio Conte. He knew he was losing Hakimi, but then he lost Lukaku. After they sat down, talked about the future, all of that, all of a sudden, he's without his great centre forward from last season. I think he's covered that very well with Edin Dzeko, or I should say more recently with a combination of Edin Dzeko and Alexis Sanchez, who's coming off the bench as if he's been fed on raw meat. You know, you're getting a few little moments out of him, aren't you? Even if he's not peak Alexis Sanchez. I guess the thing is, Nicky, you're talking about the inconsistency of these teams. When Inter are on it, they look comfortably the best team in Serie A, I think. But now it's not in their hands?
Yeah, Inter have the best team in Serie A, I think. And in particular, there's a few players who've really stood out. I think Ivan Perisic is getting up in years, but he's been brilliant the last few weeks. He's been so, so good. Marcelo Brozovic is, I think, the best central midfielder in Serie A and probably still doesn't get enough credit internationally as I think he's worth. Lautaro is very capable of being a brilliant centre forward, although he's very hot and cold. Milan is still a team of kids, you know. Rafael Leao, I think he's brilliant, is going to be brilliant, but he's still not as consistent as you want. Even at the back, players like Tomori, who I think has come on in leaps and bounds, they're still growing. But the big question that's sort of been put to Inzaghi, which keeps coming up and I think is going to haunt him if they don't do it, is are we back to pazza Inter, to crazy Inter? Because Antonio Conte's big thing was he came in and said, we're going to not be crazy Inter, we're going to be normal Inter, we're going to be boring Inter, and we're just going to win. And that's what he did, right? Once Inter got their noses in front under Conte, you just felt like, well, this is done. Like it's, and you're right, Andy, like this Inter team is weaker. They sold the most single most important player from their team last season in Lukaku and Hakimi. But I think that it's really sort of hard to know how to judge Inzaghi. And Inzaghi fired back at that exact comment this last week because he said, you know, it's 11 years, oh, I can't remember if it's 11 or 12, but it's around a decade since we won the Supercoppa. I won the Supercoppa. It's the same amount of time basically since we've been in the Coppa Italia final. We're in the Coppa Italia final. It's that amount of time again since we've been to the last 16 of the Champions League. We went to the last 16 of the Champions League. How are you going to tell me that this season is a failure just because we don't win the league title? And I think that's a valid point. But I also think I look at this Inter team. There's talk of, again, needing to cut the budget because of the owner's venture constraints this summer. And it feels like this is a window closing for them already, which is quite tough.
Yeah, indeed. That's a very question that Alex has been sending us on Instagram, asking whether this Inter team needs to sell more players, actually, to be the super club that they aspire to being.
And yeah, I think it's a really difficult time for them, clearly. I mean, their whole project has been completely sort of shifted by the financial realities of China and the Chinese government and what was required of their ownership group, Suning, who obviously invested a lot of money into winning that first title.
But what's the financial reality of Milan? I mean, Alex goes on to ask about the Investcorp takeover. I mean, how much are they actually going to put in? We know how much they're going to spend buying the club, but how much are they going to actually put in?
I think that's a TBD, but I think the level of investment into the club certainly suggests that they are willing to spend. And if they do, then look, if you ask me right now, I'd probably still say that Juventus are the favourites to win the league again next season. But I think Milan's trajectory feels, especially when you look again at, yeah, they're going to sell Frank Kessié, they're going to lose Frank Kessié this summer to Barcelona. But the amount of young quality in that squad, if you throw some money into it as well, because there are big gaps in that team. They haven't got a centre forward really other than Olivier Giroud, who's a proper number nine. And Giroud has been magnificent in the big games for them. But still, he's not at the sort of the beginning of his career, is he? I think a bit of investment into that young group and the work that Pioli's been doing, I think that team really could have huge upsides in the next year or two, if that is what the plans are. But yeah, we'll find out when they get in, basically.
But there's more expected of Inter, isn't there? If Milan don't win the title, people will imagine in Italy say, well done, and nice try and everything. But if Inzaghi doesn't win the title with Inter, then he's more likely to get the stick that he feels is unfair.
Yeah, well, this is the interesting thing, because Inzaghi sort of, as part of that same discourse I was just talking about, he said, none of you said that we were supposed to win the league at the start of the season. We weren't the favourites. And he's right. But the problem is, Juventus were the team that was supposed to beat them to the league title. No one in Italy was saying Milan are going to finish ahead of you. So when it's your neighbour and they're the team that was supposed to be behind you in the development, he's halfway right, but he's also really wrong, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, it's St. Interingham's Day. No, it doesn't work, does it? It doesn't work. I tried.
Their desperation. Oh my word, Sansone will tap it in. Andre Radu, the standing keeper, has had a howler and has that cost into the Scudetto.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Let's talk about something completely different now, because many OTC listeners at the beginning of the season might have been looking forward to what we call a different league in Europe, a different league tournament in Europe, the Europa Conference League, in any case. In its inaugural year, it was expected to be the tournament that would allow the also-rans to feature, as it were. But it does seem, towards the end of this season, that it's some of the usual suspects who are in the final stages of this Europa Conference League. How did that happen? And it wasn't supposed to happen, was it?
I don't know. I think maybe it was. I think maybe it was, because, of course, it was always sold to us as, you know, this is meant to get a wider representation from the football family. So I think the way we look at it, especially when it's got the word conference involved, which as far as football's concerned in England has a particular ring to it, I think it's fair to say. We're imagining...
It's less. Yeah. The ring in England is less than whatever else, yeah?
Yeah, I think we're imagining, you know, Norwegian clubs versus Polish clubs and stuff like that. But what this has turned out to be is like a European version of the League Cup, in that early on, and especially when it's a new competition, and a lot has been made of Brendan Rodgers, who of course left City and now in the semi-finals as we're recording. A lot has been made of him, like, just not knowing that they fell down to the Conference League. And it's been seen as a slight on the competition, a diss. I mean, he's really just used to the fact that if you don't finish in the top two in the groups in the Europa League, you're out of Europe. Mm-hmm. I think it's really quite unfair on Brendan Rodgers to say he disrespected it. But I think it's probably like the League Cup here in England, in that like the big teams treat it with, you know, a bit of half interest until they get to the back end and there's a genuine possibility. And you look at these semi-finalists and, well, if that, these are all clubs of incredible European stock, Dottenham.
Feyenoord, two European titles, Marseille, how many? Four European titles, and Roma and Leicester, of course, we know their pedigree as well. But I know you have a theory on this, Nicky. Was it Nicky or was it Andy that we spoke to early on before we started the OTC that actually this is how it was meant to be? Otherwise, those smaller clubs who don't have any European titles wouldn't be taken seriously when they come up against the likes of Feyenoord or Roma or Leicester.
Well, I think my thought was just if they'd done the Conference League without these teams, like if you did the Conference League without Leicester and without Roma, if Bodo Glimt don't get to beat Roma 6-1 in the group stage, no one in the rest of Europe is paying attention to Bodo Glimt. So the fact is that because these teams are in this competition, it's actually what makes it a big event for, or can be part of what makes it a big event for those teams. Now, maybe that still doesn't mean it's right. Maybe you still would be better off just to have a competition where Bodo Glimt, who are spectacularly good at times this competition, like really genuinely brilliant, maybe it would be better just to not have Roma in it and then they could actually have a trophy at the end of it. But I think it's fair to say that, for instance, you know, we're recording this in England, so this isn't even in Italy, but a lot of people in England who are not in Italy or in Norway saw that and thought, wow, that's an incredible result. And that's eye-opening. And wow, who are Bodo Glimt? Let's go and call up Lars and get him to tell us about their
team. As we always do. Also, let's check out their coach as well, because how on earth did he pull one over Jose Mourinho?
Exactly, exactly. So I think it's a complicated one. But I think also, you know, this is the first edition. And by the way, Jose Mourinho is all in on winning this competition. Roma are all in on winning this competition. And I think that even though it's the third competition in Europe, it would be celebrated, certainly in Rome, like something that was a huge deal.
The level of public interest there is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's quite astonishing when you think they were in a Champions League semi-final not that long ago. Mm. But yes, I think that's its own narrative. I think people in Rome have really bought into this Jose idea of glory and Europe and all of that. But you know, say it is Roma or even Leicester or any of the other clubs that are left in it that win, and then in 2 or 3 years' time, someone who isn't one of these bigger name clubs in Europe does go and win it. So, you know, say it's Rand does go and win it. Mm. It adds more prestige to it, doesn't it? Mm. In some ways, you know, they've won a competition that was won by these clubs. So there are two sides to it. There are two sides to it. I think I'm not even sort of particularly arguing that this is right. I'm just sort of saying that that's an argument for it.
And you're right. There needs to be that mix of the two sides of European football culture for people to validate it, for people to want to watch it. And as well as, you know, the sense that in European football, you want to be the best you can be and you want to come up against the best that you can. I think if it was like, say, how we initially thought it might roll out, where if you excluded teams from the top eight in the UEFA coefficient, I agree, Nicky. I don't think it's anywhere near as exciting. I think it ghettoises it a little bit. And, you know, I think it takes it away from it being a reward. I mean, the fact that Bodo Glimt have been able to play Roma four times this season as well.
And only lost to them once, by the way.
Yeah, to the fourth attempt to beat them as well. It's amazing. Not that that stopped Jose and Roma from absolutely showboating, by the way, after beating the, you know, not as strong as they were at the start of season champions of Norway. But I think really, you look at this a bit like the Nations League. I know we're all happy to put in the boot on UEFA and mainly FIFA when they get it wrong. But I think in terms of competition organisation, there are a few hits for UEFA recently. The Nations League adding meaning to the previously meaningless. And now this. I think you have to acknowledge the fact that for whatever the reasons, you know, football has become... it has become more exclusive. You know, the elite clubs have taken over a lot of the top of the game.
That's the question mark with this, isn't it? Because your comparison with, let's say,
a League Cup tournament, I think it's a good one. If it was, you know, 40 years ago or 30 years ago, maybe even 20 years ago. And I'm sorry to bring this up. I am so sorry to bring this up, Nicky. But, you know, when Don Rodgers and Swindon Town pulled one over Arsenal.
However, he's not sorry, is he?
Not really.
Look at the tears rolling down my eyes.
He's been welling that up for a year and a half.
I've been saving up now. No, but on a serious note, can you ever imagine in this new conference league tournament that a Bodø/Glimt from Norway would take on, let's say, a Leicester City, who, let's not forget, was it the quarterfinals in 2017 in the Champions League? Can you imagine them being Bodø/Glimt beating them in the final of a conference league anytime soon?
They got to the quarterfinals. They beat Roma with something to spare. They nearly beat Roma twice. Roma needed an equaliser in the group stage, didn't they, at the Olympico, right at the end to get that draw in Rome. They beat Celtic twice as well, another really established European club. But just because they haven't got the whole way, I think it's easy to look at the last four and say, oh, well, these teams have colonised it. You can't talk about a trend when it's only one season, can you?
I mean, to talk about Bodø specifically, what's stopped them from perhaps even having a chance to win this whole thing is probably less the reality of who they're playing against than the reality of the Norwegians' sort of season schedule and the players they sold. The team that beat Roma then sort of had a full asset stripping in its off-season and still went and beat Roma again in the first leg. So I think, yeah, they could have beaten anyone the way they were in the group
stage. So next season, do you hope for better from the Conference League then?
You know what I hope for next season? I hope for a stadium that's a bit bigger for the final. Because remember, it's great again that somewhere different gets to host a European final in Tirana. And it's not just because it's going to be underlined, of course, because of the sort of clubs that are in the semi-finals. But having a UEFA Club Competition final that's got a 22,000 capacity final, especially when you take away the sponsors' tickets, is not ideal. I've thought for a long time that the stadiums in which they have the Europa League final are too small. And this just underlines it. Let the people in.
Indeed. And a reminder that you can tweet us at any time during the course of the week at Football Ramble, at Dotton Adebayo, at Andy Brassel, and at Nicky Bandini. And this is a great question, actually. You might have to explain the context of this because I think I missed the celebrations. But this is from Danny, who says, what's the story behind Trabzonspor's league title win? And boy, do they look like they know how to celebrate. What's the celebration?
It's been a long festival of celebrating in Trabzon. And the good thing is, because they've been so far ahead at the top of the league, a bit like Real Madrid on the Black Sea, if you like, Real Madrid Black Sea branch, that they have had time to build this up, to prepare it, to, you know, grasp the moment that, you know, this is going to be where we're really going to let loose and celebrate their first title since 1984. And in that time, they've, between now and back then, they've come close. They've signed some big players. They've spent some money on wages. It's never quite got them there. And it's such a passionately followed club, Trabzonspor. A couple of things have gone right for them. Firstly, and we can't really shy away from this, the big Istanbul clubs have been crap this season. And, you know, they've not played well. They've not team built well. Fenerbahce, Galatasaray, Beşiktaş, all changed coach as well mid-season, which has been an indication of how they've gone out. Fenerbahce have recovered a bit in recent weeks. A bit too late to challenge for the title, but it looks like they're going to make the Champions League qualifiers. And Trabzon have been really consistent. Now, part of that has been that they've got some really good experienced players in. Now, Bruno Peres is there. Marek Hamšík has come back after that little, I suppose, like the French would call it, pige at Gothenburg. And he's been really important and influential for them this season. They made the right signings in January as well. Edin Visca, who knows the Turkish league really well, who's a title winner with Başakşehir, that was really important for them as well. And fortunately for them, when they've had the nerves in recent weeks, they drew like I think four out of the last five. It was a draw against Sivasspor that got them over the line. They were far enough in front for it not to really matter.
So that was important to them. I'm really interested to see how they get on in the
Champions
League.
What about the celebrations? You haven't told us anything about the celebrations.
It was mad. It was inside, outside the stadium, in the city, everywhere.
Yeah,
and the players are in the middle of it somewhere.
You need the entire city
to
celebrate.
There's a whole light show as well. But yeah, what an incredible denouement to Marek Hamšík's European career.
He's speaking French. Qu'est-ce que c'est le pige? Je comprends le dénouement, mais le pige, qu'est-ce que c'est?
It's like a little temporary post.
Okay. Sorry, Nikki.
I think it always seems like Turkey has the most enthusiastic title celebrations. I'm forgetting who it was who had the flotilla of boats. That was extraordinary.
Ooh, gosh, yeah.
That was Beşiktaş.
Was that Beşiktaş?
Because the stadium is right on the Bosphorus.
Mm.
Mm. So you could potentially jump off the top of the main stand into the river onto the boat.
Lord Byron,
you would have landed
there
on a boat because there was no free space between the boats. There was just no water that wasn't just occupied by a boat. I don't know how they did it. It was incredible.
And Lord Byron had a gammy leg when he swam it as well. Anyway, we're looking for what? I have to bring in a literary reference, otherwise it doesn't make sense. It's strange people.
As Jimmy Nail would say, it's a big river. So he's done a good job there, Lord Byron.
Did a good job indeed. Now, we want a game of the week from each of you. Who wants to go first?
I'll pick up for now. Funny enough. So I think Milan Verona could be game of the week, but I've gone for one from the other end of the Serie A table. And it's funny because it's Salernitana against Cagliari. Which I'll get into why it's game of the week in a second, but I was just looking at the maps earlier, and somehow by accident I'd managed to sort of get Google Maps to give me directions from Salernitana, from Salerno, in fact, the city where they're based, to Cagliari. Now Cagliari's in Sardinia, so there's you know, ocean between them, and Google Maps just had a go at it anyway and said you could walk there in a day, and I just thought, maybe that's the answer. Byron and his gammy leg could have swum it in a day. It would be ambitious. But listen, Salernitana are pulling off one of sort of the great escapes of recent Serie A past. They've been bottom of the table for almost the entire season, but they've taken 10 points from the last four games. They've got Davide Nicola in charge, who some people might remember pulled off one of Serie A's greatest ever escapes, like Crotone a few years ago, where he took a team that was on 14 points, I think, after 29 games and got them to safety and then did a sort of personal Giro d'Italia cycling the country.
Great shoe throwing the other week as well.
Yes. Had a hilarious moment.
One of those George Bush shoe
throws. Who were they
throws?
Playing? No, I'm trying to think which game it was they were playing, but yes, they were.
It's against Fiorentina, where he had that meltdown when they weren't defending properly and he took off one of his trainers and threw it.
That's what happened to George W. Bush, not remember.
No, because George Bush had one thrown at him by someone in the crowd.
Yeah.
This was the manager.
Right.
And he didn't throw it at the players, but he threw it in sort of fury down the touchline, then went and picked it up. And there's this great visual of him sort of clutching it and just menacing his players. It worked. They won the game.
He's threatening them with a slipper.
Basically.
Around their head rather than the bottom.
But yeah, they've gone from bottom of the table to currently, I think they are 2 points behind Cagliari. I should probably double check that before coming on. But yes, you know, there's basically three teams fighting for one spot, realistically. Valencia technically could as well, but I think Valencia are gone now. Three teams fighting for 17th spot, which is Genoa, Cagliari and Salernitana. So Cagliari are the team currently in 17th, Salernitana are behind them in 18th. And so if Salernitana win, and it's at the Arechi, which is their home stadium, which is an incredibly passionate little stadium, really sort of brilliant atmospheres there all season, they could vault Cagliari and get out of the relegation zone, which would be pretty extraordinary given that they've been bottom of the table for basically the whole season.
That is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
If it happened. By the way, Julius Caesar tried to swim the Tiber. No, it's true. If you believe Shakespeare, Cassius says he tried to swim it and then he had to gasp and help, ask Cassius to help him.
What did he eat after the swim?
Good question. You must know that, Nikki. What should we eat?
What Julius Caesar had. I was thinking about what you could have for this game, and I think when I think about Salerno, when I think about Sardinia or Cagliari, I think clams. So, you know, in Salerno, you might have them with spaghetti. In Cagliari, you might have them with fregola, which is like this sort of Italian, similar to couscous, but made with pasta. And yeah, that's a little bit of that with some, I don't know, some just very simple, probably with some garlic and some.
I don't know about waiting for the game. I'm getting a few lunch ideas here.
Well, I was thinking if it's Sardinia, it's got to be sardines. Do you want to save me there? Do you want to save me there?
I think that is what you would call a Pinterest pause.
I apologise. Yeah, you've got a game of the week as well.
You know what? Normally I would go for Atletico Madrid versus Real Madrid.
Why not?
Especially as Atletico need to win it to secure their Champions League place. Mm-hmm. They've been poor nick at the moment. And because, of course, they've refused to give Real Madrid a guard of honour onto the pitch. They put out this incredible statement, which has been... I mean, there are a few greater things, I think, than Google translations of overseas football club statements. The Irish Daily Mirror interpreted the Atletico statement thus: some want to turn what was born as a gesture of recognition of the champion into a public toll that must be paid by their rivals, also impregnated with the aroma of humiliation.
We like that.
And Diego Simeone is not going to be impregnated with the aroma of humiliation, is it? But in fact, I'm not going to do that. I don't want to wait that long. Let's go Saturday night. Let's go 6 p.m. Let's go possibly the next title winner in Europe. Mm. Porto are going to Benfica at 6 p.m. It's on BT Sport here in the UK, I think. And a point will do it for Porto. We'll make them mathematically champions. Best team in Portugal. They deserve it. They've seen off a very, very good Sporting side. Now, of course, Benfica, who can no longer qualify for the Champions League, automatically they'll have to go in the qualifiers, where we think Fenerbahce are going. When we fast forward to July, or you know, it will be July, won't it, with the World Cup and whatnot. There is history for this, a recent history of Porto winning the title at the Estádio da Luz. Benfica, the earliest ever Portuguese title win, André Villas-Boas' side, back in 2011, unbeaten season. They win 2-1 at Benfica to win the league. At that game, and Benfica later claimed there'd been a power shortage in the stadium. Basically, as Porto celebrated on the pitch, they just turned the lights off in the stadium.
It's enough Atletico, like, Madrid, isn't it?
Obviously, people are still trying to get out of the ground and can't see where they're going. And anyway, the sort of reserve backup lights come on and all these sprinklers go off. And basically all the Porto players start jumping in, like they're in the Cibeles fountain, like they're Real Madrid players. And they really make the most of it. So I'm interested to see if Porto get the point there, if they do something similar. Now, obviously, if it's a title win, it's all about the drinks, really. It's about beers and champagne. So you just need a little prego, a Portuguese steak sandwich on the side, I reckon.
I know other...
Soak up the booze.
Other Porto wines are available, but Mateus Rosé, you know, you've got to go for that, haven't you?
Yeah, why not?
Football Ramble Presents is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly. Seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.